ask.
So I'm 26 years old.
What makes you so brave?
Porque estamos, bueno, yo creo que porque nacimos en un pueblo.
So I was born into a people of great dignity and of great strength. And my mother, Berta Cáceres, instilled upon us from a very young age, you know, that the struggle is rooted in dignity, and that, you know, we must continue forward defending the rights of our people.
Cambiar la situación de nuestras comunidades y también de nuestro país.
That was Bertita Zúñiga Cáceres, the daughter of Berta Cáceres, the Honduran indigenous environmentalist assassinated March 2, 2016. Bertita herself just survived an assassination attempt. Special thanks to Brigitte Ginther. We were also joined by Matt Ginsburg Jekyll, a longtime friend of both Bertita and her mother. And Bertita was speaking to us from her home in La Esperanza, Honduras. She has now replaced her mother as head of COPING, the indigenous environmental organization. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the benefit screening of Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, on Friday, July 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years. The film features personal stories of resistance told by victims of police misconduct, the families of people who were killed by police, and members of Portland reform and abolition movements. The screening is a benefit for the Portland chapter of the NAACP. Again, that's a screening of the documentary film Arresting Power, Friday, July 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 9th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as KBOO Night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located on the corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton in Portland. Schedule an info at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. And coming up next is your Friday KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a report from Senator Merkley says that insurance premiums will rise by 300% to 600% under the Senate health care bill.
Oregon imposes a bicycle tax as part of a $5.3 billion transportation package.
As many as 100,000 protesters greeted global leaders at the G20 summit meeting today in Hamburg, Germany.
Thank you. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 7th, 2017. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. According to a report released today by Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, older Oregonians would face massive increases in health insurance premiums under the Republicans' Senate's Better Care Resolution Act. The report was prepared by the Kaiser Family Foundation and focuses on the cost to low-income senior citizens. It compares anticipated premiums under the proposed BCRA versus the current Affordable Care Act, generally referred to as Obamacare. According to the study, a 60-year-old earning $20,000 a year would face premium increases of between 300 and 600% by the year 2020, depending on which county they lived in. Some of the state's most rural counties would be hit hardest. In Gilliam, Morrow, Sherman, and Wheeler counties, seniors would see increases of 614%. Under current law, the average 60-year-old pays an estimated $960 per year after tax credits. That equates to about 5% of their income. Under the BCRA, however, the tax credits would be reduced by 11% and premiums would rise by over 30%. That same senior would now need to spend a third of their annual income, nearly $7,000 per year, if they want to maintain their health insurance for the final years before Medicaid kicks in at age 65. In other rural and coastal counties, the premium increases would fall between 5 and 600%, and Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties would see increases of over 325%.
Yesterday, the Oregon legislature approved a $5.3 billion transportation bill. The long overdue package is focused on congestion and public transportation, as well as road and bridge repair. The transportation package was introduced by the Joint Transportation Preservation and Modernization Committee. The recommendations came from an 18-month study that included an 11-stop tour of Oregon to meet with community members. The funding comes from a combination of tax and fee increases, including a 4-cent gas tax, a $16 increase in vehicle registration fees, a 0.1% payroll tax, and a 0.5% tax on new car sales. And in a uniquely Oregonian move, the bill calls for a flat $15 tax on new adult bicycle sales. The tax will be put on bicycles with wheels that are 26 inches or wider and with a retail price of $200 or more. The bill passed the House with a bipartisan vote of 39 to 20, easily exceeding the 3/5 majority that is required to pass a tax increase. The bill now moves to the Senate, and with only a few days left in this legislative session, a vote is expected soon. The transportation package was one of Governor Brown's priorities this session, and it is expected that she will quickly sign the bill if it passes.
Immigrant rights advocates want clear guidelines for the types of information that states and local agencies can release about undocumented Oregonians. And Oregon lawmakers have only a few more days to consider HB 3464, a bill that does just that. Eric Tegahoff of the Oregon News Service has this report.
As Oregon lawmakers enter their final days of the session, immigrants' rights advocates are pushing state senators to pass a bill protecting the privacy of undocumented Oregonians. Governor Kate Brown and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum spearheaded House Bill 3464 to give guidelines to state entities on what information can and cannot be shared with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Opponents of the bill say it undermines federal law by shielding people who are undocumented. But Andrea Williams, who heads the immigrants' advocacy group CAUSA, says the bill is compliant with federal and state laws.
So it's not just about what information they are keeping private. It's also about making sure that schools and courthouses and other public entities aren't held liable. If they are keeping information, they should be sharing, right? So it's really to provide clarity and direction.
HB 3464 is currently in the state Senate. The legislative session ends on Monday, July 10th. Data from the Department of Homeland Security shows a 40% increase in arrests and deportations so far this year over last. Williams says arrests by ICE agents outside of courthouses and schools in Oregon are on the rise. She thinks it's especially troubling that parents are being arrested when the state doesn't have the resources to take care of children when parents are deported.
It's a moral issue because you're leaving most of whom are U.S. citizen children without parents. and without a support system, without a breadwinner.
Williams says HB 3464 makes the state more inclusive for all residents and keeps more people in the workforce, helping the economy. She also praises legislation passed this week that expands health coverage to Oregon's 15,000 undocumented children. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon is poised to become the third state in the nation to increase its tobacco sales age to 21. Yesterday, the House voted 39-20 in favor of Senate Bill 754, which raises the legal age for tobacco purchases from 18 to 21. The House version contains amendments, but the Senate is expected to accept them, and if that happens, the bill would then go to Governor Brown for her signature. The age increase would go into effect immediately. Legislators noted that the bill is about saving both lives and money, noting that Oregonians spend about $3 billion a year on tobacco-related illnesses. Oregon would be joining California and Hawaii as the only states to restrict tobacco sales to those 21 and above.
Continuing to push back against President Trump's climate policies, California Governor Jerry Brown called for a 2018 climate summit in San Francisco. The governor made the announcement in a video message for attendees of the Global Citizen Festival in Hamburg, Germany. In the video, Brown said, quote, "I know President Trump is trying to get out of the Paris Agreement, but he doesn't speak for the rest of America," end quote. He went on to say that it was up to all of us to, quote, "roll back the forces of carbonization and join together to combat the existential threat of climate change," end quote. At the beginning of June, Trump announced the United States would withdraw from the Paris Agreement. He said that the accord allowed other countries to gain an economic advantage versus the United States and promised to negotiate a new agreement. The announcement prompted a barrage of criticism from supporters of the accord, with many economists pointing out that withdrawal from the accord would cause far more economic damage than remaining. After the announcement, Brown's office pointed out that the summit would represent the first time a U.S. state would host an international climate change conference with the direct goal of supporting the Paris Agreement.
Walter Schaub Jr., head of the Independent Office of Government Ethics since 2013, has resigned his position. This came after repeated pushback from the Trump administration to his professional guidance. In an interview on Thursday, Schaub said, quote, "There isn't much more I could accomplish at the Office of Government Ethics given the current situation," end quote. Prior to inauguration, his recommendation was that Trump divest all of his business holdings to avoid any conflicts of interest. Instead, Trump chose to turn over management of his holdings to his two oldest sons. Schaub stated that he was, quote, "extremely troubled," end quote, by this choice. During an interview in February, Kellyanne Conway encouraged Americans to support Ivanka Trump's clothing line. Schaub suggested that she be disciplined for those comments and was ignored. Recently, in a routine request, Schaub asked for copies of waivers that had been issued to appointees of the Trump administration. The Office of Management and Budgets questioned his legal authority and asked him to withdraw the request. The White House eventually released the waivers after receiving a 10-page rebuttal from Schaub. The waivers revealed numerous exemptions made to aides working on policy issues they had previously worked on as lobbyists. While Schaub's resignation provides the opportunity for the president to nominate a successor, his choice will require Senate confirmation. This could result in closer scrutiny of Trump's entangled business empire.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Rising Up with Sonali at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in Portland calls for early morning clouds giving way to a sunny day with temperatures in the mid to upper 80s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can look forward to a sunny day with a high around 90. On this date in 1976, women were admitted to the Corps of Cadets at West Point for the first time. 62 went on to graduate and be commissioned as second lieutenants. The quote of the day is from Brigadier General Anne F. McDonald, a member of the first class to graduate. She said, quote, "As with anything new, there is some hesitation and reluctance to change. The reaction from the men ran the gamut. Some were curious, some ignored us, some were helpful, and some were hostile and difficult," end quote.
In today's episode of This Week in Water, Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin look at American concerns about drinking water in the wake of the Flint, Michigan disclosures. They also shine a light on efforts by the EPA to pressure an administrator into changing her testimony about the Trump administration's decision to dismiss many of the EPA scientists.
The country of Pakistan may be running out of water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
There's a severe and chronic water shortage in the entire country of Pakistan, a situation that is not expected to improve.
There's little to no water flowing in pipelines in Karachi, a city of at least 25 million, according to a member of parliament who spoke to the Express Tribune. He noted that a black market of tankers is selling water at exorbitant rates.
People in cities around the country have recently had to fill water jugs from public stations at 3 in the morning, according to the Washington Post.
Day-to-day life in Pakistan is made more difficult because there have been major cutbacks in electricity. One man said that in his house, his family can use only one light and one fan. Recently, temperatures in parts of the country reached over 127 degrees Fahrenheit.
People in agriculture are dependent on water flowing from India, with whom Pakistan has had three wars and much political strife. Tensions are higher now as India's Prime Minister Modi promotes Hindu nationalistic policies.
The crisis in Pakistan is dire as global warming reduces the amount of water that will flow from glaciers to rivers and as groundwater is being diminished due to overpumping.
The Pakistan Council of Research in Water Resources warns that the whole country could run out of water as early as 2025 if authorities do not act immediately.
A poll was released at the Aspen Ideas Festival revealing Americans are concerned on a nationwide basis about their drinking water.
The sampling showed that 2 out of 3 Americans believe their community is vulnerable to a water crisis, and 1/3 of those polled said they question whether the water in homes and schools is clean and safe.
The survey done by Nestle Waters comes in the wake of the crisis in Flint, Michigan, which no doubt has raised awareness about the importance of water.
And it comes at the same time that the Trump administration announced it was beginning the process to redefine what waters are protected under the Clean Water Act.
The Obama administration had crafted a rule which would have protected more than half of the country's rivers, streams, and wetlands from pollutants.
And now, presumably, the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers will craft a rule that is not nearly as inclusive and which will possibly create even more anxiety about the country's drinking water.
Speaking of the EPA, it was learned last week that a Trump political appointee in the agency tried to bully a top science advisor into altering her testimony to Congress.
Deborah Swackhammer, a retired professor at the University of Minnesota and leader of the EPA Science Advisory Panel, was set to testify about Trump's decision to dismiss most of the board's members.
The panel is not directly involved in the agency's studies, but gives critical feedback on how those studies are conducted, assuring that the science is good.
Swackhammer had already prepared her statements to Congress, commenting that the dismissals could lead to the perception that science was being politicized and marginalized within the EPA.
The day before she was set to testify, she received emails from Ryan Jackson, the chief of staff of the EPA under Scott Pruitt.
He told her that decisions had not been made about whether to dismiss the scientists. However, some of them had already received letters to that effect. The official even included talking points urging Swackhammer to rework the testimony she had already released.
Swackhammer told the New York Times that she was stunned by his emails and felt bullied. Democrats have asked the EPA's inspector general to investigate the claims that the chief of staff pressured Swackhammer.
Since her testimony, the EPA has sent out dozens more notices that scientists' terms on the panel will not be renewed.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn about water efficiency and resilience at awwa.org/sustainable.
Earlier today, the Department of Homeland Security released a report alleging that 12 nuclear power plants across the United States had their computer systems hacked in May and June. Russian government-sponsored hackers are suspected of being behind the breach. The hackers accessed computer systems at a dozen nuclear power plants or more, including the Wolf Creek nuclear facility in Kansas. Officials of the DHS said that the techniques used by the hackers mimicked those used by a Russian hacking group called Energetic Bear, which is believed to have been responsible for repeated attacks on the global energy sector since 2012. According to the report from Homeland Security, the hackers sent emails with fake resumes to industrial control engineers who have access to critical control systems. If clicked, the resumes infected computers, allowing the hackers to access other machines on the network. In a joint statement, the FBI and Homeland Security said, quote, "There is no indication of a threat to public safety, as any potential impact appears to be limited to administrative and business networks." End quote.
Violent protests erupted in Germany Thursday on the eve of the Group of 20 summit in Hamburg. An estimated 12,000 protesters were on hand, including about 1,000 from the Black Bloc anarchist group. Some people in the group threw rocks and bottles at police while carrying signs saying, "Welcome to hell." German security forces and riot gear used water cannons and pepper spray to break an anti-capitalist march. An unknown number of protesters were arrested, and police sources said that 76 officers were injured during Thursday's violence. The violence continued today as world leaders arrived in Hamburg for the actual start of the meeting. As many as 100,000 protesters may have been on hand to greet them. Latest reports say that about 100 people have been arrested, and the number of police injured during the skirmishes has risen to nearly 200. Reports from earlier today say that First Lady Melania Trump, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, and others were trapped in their hotels by protesters and unable to attend the summit. The G20 is an international forum for the governments and central bank governors from 20 major economies. The latest estimates are that it represents nearly 85% of the world's GDP and about two-thirds of the world's population. This group gets together to discuss policies that promote, quote, "international financial stability," end quote. Since its founding in 1999, G20 summits have frequently been the site of clashes between police and a wide range of protesters.
In this episode of Labor History, in 2 minutes, Rick Smith details the Pullman strike of 1894.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day thousands of Pullman strikers confronted state militia forces at the Grand Trunk Railroad crossing in Chicago. The strike began on May 11th after George Pullman slashed wages but refused to lower rents in his company town. In late June, Eugene V. Debs and the American Railway Union called for a national boycott of all Pullman cars. The boycott spread to 27 states, involving more than 150,000 workers. Attorney General Richard Olney issued an injunction declaring the strike illegal on July 2nd. The injunction failed to break the strike, but it did prevent union leaders from communicating with strikers. The next day, President Cleveland ordered troops into Chicago rail yards to crush the strike. Workers were furious. They flooded the yards, stopping trains, smashing switches, and barricading themselves with baggage cars. Fighting continued for several days as angry strikers stormed rail yards and overturned empty freight cars. Thousands of workers impacted by the Depression joined in, including those stranded in the city after the Columbian Exposition. Two strikers were shot dead on the Illinois Central Railroad on July 6th. Workers responded by setting fire to hundreds of rail cars. Now, on this day, the militia attempted to run a work train to clear the rail yard at 49th and Loomis. Thousands followed the train, showering it with bricks and stones. The troops returned gunfire, killing at least four and injuring dozens. Chicago unions soon voted in favor of a citywide sympathy strike, but the railroads quickly hired replacement labor. Federal troops and state militia cleared the railway for business. Maine strike leaders were arrested. By the beginning of August, Pullman rehired only those strikers who agreed to never join a union.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Working people brought this bill to a screeching halt. We mobilized in record time, and we're not about to stand down.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka on the stalled Republican Senate health care bill. Labor isn't letting up in its campaign to stop this bill.
We're running ads. We're flooding Senate offices with phone calls. We're mobilizing in the states. We're going all out. It's time for Congress to abandon this reckless plan and come together on a bipartisan basis to improve the Affordable Care Act. That's what voters want.
Trumka says the AFL-CIO isn't fooled by what Trump and his Republicans are doing with this so-called health care bill.
Make no mistake, this bill isn't a health care plan at all. It's a massive transfer of wealth from workers to Wall Street. It obliterates Medicaid. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, it will increase the number of uninsured Americans by 22 million, and it cuts taxes for millionaires while it raises taxes on hardworking men and women who have negotiated high-quality health care. This bill is a sham, and it's a shame. So working families are fighting back. We're fighting for our children, our parents, in our community. This is a vicious, vicious assault on America's healthcare security.
Sandra Falwell is a D.C. registered nurse and a member of National Nurses United.
This bill poses a mortal threat to the health and well-being of our country. As registered nurses, we recognize that this is an extremely mean-spirited and callous bill that would substantially harm our patients. Instead of kicking tens of millions of people off of health insurance, we need to move forward to the only system that will guarantee that everyone has access to safe therapeutic health care, a single-payer Medicare for all.
For Zahara Heckscher, a breast cancer survivor being treated with very expensive medicines, the GOP health care bill is life-threatening.
Health insurance means that I can do the treatments that my doctors think is best, take the modern medicines that my doctors think are going to extend my life as long as possible.
Seven government employee unions oppose privatization of America's air traffic control system. Republicans in the House version of the FAA reauthorization bill included privatization. The unions, including AFGE, AFSCME, and the National Association of Government Employees, say that, quote, overhauling the entire aviation system by removing air traffic control from federal oversight and funding will be a serious setback for its development and growth. End quote. WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada, online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you've been at a local event and have audio or video that you want to share with the KABU audience, we want to hear from you. Call us at 503-231-8032 or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kabu.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sharon Deegan and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up on Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time and goes where corporate media fears to tread. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to Eric DePlace of Seattle's Sightline Institute about Northwest communities under threat from dirty energy development. At 11, it's Health Watch, information to make you healthier. And at 11:30, Intersections Radio connects communities through unique and unexpected stories. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Thank you and good night. And good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, guys.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, AP reports hundreds of Iraqi civilians fleeing Mosul's old city, climbing over rubble as explosions rock the streets while government forces battle the Islamic State. Cameroonian officials deny UN reports they've driven out at least 5,000